Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today. The National Institute on Mental Health estimates that one in four Americans ages 18 and older suffers from a mental disorder in a given year. About 6% of the population suffers from a serious mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. In fact, mental disorders are the leading cause of disability in the United States and Canada for ages 15 to 54. Since the 1950s, when antipsychotic medications became available, and especially since the development of antidepressants in the 1990s, psychiatric drugs have become a mainstay, if not the mainstay, of mental illness treatment in America. Now questions are being raised about the long-term outcomes for patients treated with psychiatric medications like Prozac or Paxil or Zoloft and countless others. We are going to talk with the author of the book Anatomy of an Epidemic. Robert Whitaker is a correspondent with the Boston Globe. He has written the book Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. It won the 2010 Investigative Reporters and Editors Award for Best Investigative Journalism. Robert Whitaker, thanks for joining us here on All Sides.
Oh, thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here.
Later this hour, we'll talk with a psychiatrist who treats mentally ill patients, and we'll speak with a man who has overcome his mental illness without the help or no longer needs the help of medication to deal with his illness. And we welcome your calls at 292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Robert Whitaker, you allege in your book that the American psychiatric industry or community is colluding with the pharmaceutical industry, and it's making us sicker as far as mental illness is concerned. That's a pretty serious allegation. Why do you say that?
Well, I'm not sure I make quite that allegation.
Okay.
What I look at in this book is a fundamental question, because as you said, psychiatric drugs have really become a mainstay of treatment. Mm-hmm. Prozac arrived on the market in 1987. It's since the arrival of Prozac that we've really embraced the use of these drugs. So in 1987, as a country, we spent about $800 million on psychiatric medications. In 2007, we were spending about $40 billion. So that's an extraordinary increase in use of drugs and spending on drugs. So, you know, so many people are using them. It seems like mental illness is becoming ever more of a subject. And what I wanted to do in this book is really ask this question. Is this paradigm of care really working for us? And as a first way to look at that, I just looked at the number of people on disability due to mental illness and how it's changed since 1987. So in 1987, we had roughly 1.25 million adults on disability due to mental illness. Now we have about 4.5 million. So even as we're using the drugs more, we're getting more of a burden of mental illness in our society, which just raises questions. What's going on? And I'll get to your question about the collusion.
Sure.
And what you find when you look at this, and I've been writing about science and medicine for a long time, and what I wanted to do in this book is take a different question. We know the medications may work over the short term. That's why they get approved by the FDA for approval. What I wanted to look at is how are medications shaping long-term outcomes in the aggregate? In other words, someone who comes in with depression, does their long-term course, is it better than it used to be? And when you look at this perspective of how the medications are shaping long-term outcomes, you actually see a lot of increased chronicity in the modern age. In other words, depression runs a more chronic course. Bipolar runs a more chronic course than it used to. You also see an extraordinary explosion in the number of bipolar patients. It used to be a fairly rare disorder. It used to be about 1 in 5,000 adults. We're now 1 in 50. So there's a lot of questions raised by the long-term perspective. Now, your question, is there been
the role of drugs in this?
Well, yeah, during this drug era, we're seeing this shift to greater chronicity. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is what I found when I looked through the literature, I found a lot of long-term outcome studies that sort of belied the story that we're told as a population about the drugs being absolutely essential long-term, like insulin for diabetes. And these are studies funded by the NIMH for really responsible organizations. And then the question becomes, why don't we know these outcomes? So, for example, there's a long-term schizophrenia study done by Martin Harrow at the University of Illinois. It's the 20-year study, and quite surprisingly, it was the off-medication group that had a much higher recovery rate, about an 8 times higher recovery rate. Now, the question is, why don't we know that? And this gets into the sort of collusion thing, is what happens is you have pharmaceutical companies who've been paying psychiatrists at academic medical schools to be speakers, advisors, consultants. And that shapes what they tell the public. And that's the bit of the collusion you're talking about.
Yeah, we'll get into the how the studies are done, how they're published, and what it takes to get a drug approved in a moment. When it comes to the prevalence or the increased diagnosis of mental illness, some argue that it's because the stigma has been removed from mental illness that was there 20, 30, 40 years ago and even farther back, and the diagnosis has improved. How much of is it the drugs alone, or is it increased awareness of the symptoms of mental illness and an increased willingness on the part of patients to say, you know, I may have depression or I may have a mental illness?
Right. This is a really great question, and I don't think there's a really easy answer. One of the things is that we've expanded the boundaries of what we consider mental illness, okay? In other words, the symptoms you must have in order to get a bipolar diagnosis, they've greatly expanded. Mm-hmm. Same with depression, et cetera. That's one. Two, in a sense, we've marketed depression. We've marketed these illnesses. In other words, we have drug companies that make antidepressants. Of course, they want to increase their market for that. And you can go on TV and watch your ads. And that helps encourage people to sort of see themselves within this framework and all of society to see themselves within this framework as well. So there's a little bit of a marketing story involved as well. And then I think there is something to do with a decrease in the stigma. People are more willing to say, hey, I'm suffering in this way. I'm struggling in this way. I want to come for help. And that definitely has happened in the last 20 years. It's more acceptable to go for help.
We're speaking with Robert Whitaker, author of the book Anatomy of an Epidemic, talking about psychiatric drugs and are they being perhaps overprescribed, especially in the long term, to treat mental illness in the United States. 292-8513. We'd like to speak with you. Our question, do you believe that we use too much medicine to treat mental illness? Have you benefited from medications? Have you overcome mental illness without the medications? 292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Getting into some of the science, what causes the reason why we have medications is the theory is that a mental illness is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain. Your body is absorbing too much serotonin, for instance, in the brain that causes depression. Do you believe there's the chemical imbalances are to blame for mental illness?
See, this is a really key story. We've been told that, say, depression is due to low serotonin, and therefore the drug ups serotonin, and it fixes that balance and that chemical imbalance, like insulin for diabetes. If you actually look into the science of this, the low serotonin theory of depression fell apart in the early 1980s, and then it was brought back to the public as part of a way to market Prozac. But so, for example, in 2000, a well-known molecular psychopharmacologist named Steven Stahl, he says, listen, the truth is there is no real serotonin deficit in depression. We didn't find it to be so. A very famous psychiatrist named Ronald Pies, writing in Psychiatric Times just this summer, said, listen, no well-informed psychiatrist believes in the chemical imbalance theory. It's sort of an urban myth. So there's this extraordinary disparity between what they actually found when they looked into depressed patients. Did they find people had low serotonin? They did not. But unfortunately, that has not been communicated to the public.
But there are millions of folks who take serotonin inhibitors,
right,
Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, those drugs, that feel better. And when they're on them, and they're glad they're on them, it relieves their symptoms of depression, feeling the blues and anxiety and that kind of thing. They probably believe that there's a chemical imbalance and the medication's helping them.
Well, that they have a chemical imbalance and the medications can help people, okay? But I'm just terms and telling of it. We don't know the biology of depression. That's really the story, okay? And why the drugs may work for some people is something of a mystery. But the idea that they're fixing a chemical imbalance, which is sort of like they're an antidote to a known pathological problem, it's just not true. Mm-hmm. And once you understand that it's not true, you can understand why reactions to the drugs can be so varied. So over the short term, hey, listen, there's many people that will say, boy, these drugs saved my life, antidepressants, got me out of a depression. Are there people on antidepressants long term who will say, boy, I love these drugs, they've helped me immeasurably? Absolutely. But if you actually look at the science, say for mild to moderate depression, even over the short term, antidepressants don't beat placebo, even over the short term. And then over the long term, what you see in the data is a lot of chronicity in people on the drugs long term. There was just an article published this summer where they're calling it tardive dysphoria, where after a long period of time in the drugs, there's a certain percentage of people who end up with treatment-resistant depression. It becomes chronic. Now, that's not part of the story we generally hear. And outcomes are really variable. They're along a spectrum. And one of the reasons I think they're along a spectrum is who knows what the biology involved is.
You're not opposed to the short-term use of these medications.
And I'm not even opposed to the long-term use in
but
certain
you,
instances.
You caution that the long-term effects could be quite damaging. What happens over the long-term?
Well, what happens, I mean, if you want to talk about the biology, what happens is the drug modifies the brain in a way. The brain tries to compensate for the drug's presence. So let's say you go on an SSRI, and what an SSRI does is it blocks the reuptake of serotonin, up serotonergic activity. Your brain actually changes because of that increased serotonergic activity and actually goes into a low serotonergic state. This is the irony. We say that depression is caused by low serotonin. Prior to going on the drug, you really don't have a deficit. But after on the drug, your receptor densities for serotonin actually decline. Your outnormal output of serotonin declines. And so you actually physiologically go into a low serotonergic state. And scientists call this the body trying to retain its homeostatic equilibrium.
This is the same argument that cholesterol folks would make, that if you took a cholesterol drug to lower your cholesterol, or adjusted your diet, that your body would just, to some degree, make more cholesterol to make up for that.
Well, basically, that is the sort of thing. It's this compensatory adaptation is what happens. And the thought is, what the researchers are saying is over the long term, you're driving the brain into this low serotonergic state, and for some people, that results in a chronic depression. So the problem we have here is, again, I think we have to figure out for whom and for how long. That's a much more selective, subtle use than one size fits all. And I think if researchers spend a lot of time looking at the long-term outcomes, they'd be much more cautious about long-term use.
Our guest this hour is Robert Whitaker. He is the author of Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America. We'll continue our discussion in a moment as All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. WOSU Public Media presents Chefs in the City 2012, featuring celebrity chef Hubert Keller, along with an elite group of Central Ohio culinary greats, including Travis Hyde of Ella in New Albany, who is currently showcased on our Facebook page. Be sure to like Chefs in the City on Facebook or visit WOSU.org/chefs.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, presenting RESPECT, The Legends of Soul, with guest artists Chris Pierce and Bobby Towns, April 11th through the 15th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
47 degrees in downtown Columbus, a few clouds and some sunshine today, a high of 55. Clear skies tonight, a little chilly, a low of 35 degrees. And expect some frost tomorrow morning, sunshine in the afternoon, a high near 60. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the use of psychiatric medications to treat mental illness in America. We're looking at the long-term outcomes and effects of these medications. And are the powerful drug companies concealing the hazards of popular drugs like Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft? Joining us now by phone is psychiatrist Kevin Ware. He is the chair and medical director of the Department of Psychiatry at the Mount Carmel Medical Center. He also works at the Southeast Recovery and Mental Health Care Services in Columbus. Dr. Ware, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
Southeast is one of the largest behavioral health care organizations in Ohio. It treats 12,000 people a year. Dr. Ware, of the patients with mental illness, how many take medication that you treat?
The ones that I treat, a majority do take medication. That's mainly what I do there.
Mm-hmm. Is that Is that too many? Do you often question that? Do all these folks need the medication? What are your thoughts on the fears that we're relying too heavily on this medication?
Well, I see medication as only part of the treatment approach. We utilize a biopsychosocial model, which includes looking at the biological piece and the medications and the psychosocial aspects, which also are amenable to treatment, including the psychotherapies. And you know, a lot of the patients, when I see them at the mental health center, they're very ill, and it's been a lot of times long-term that the condition has continued. And so we use all available treatment approaches, and one including medication.
So in a scale, what do you see as the level of importance of the medication compared to those other things that you mentioned?
Well, it is one of the cornerstones of treatment. And, you know, I'm a medical doctor and, you know, have studied, you know, in medical school and a four-year residency, and continue to educate myself about the treatments and the medications. And, you know, the newer medications certainly have advantages, and we see improvement with the treatments, and, you know, it's not always as effective as you would like, unfortunately, but we do, you know, continue to work on getting the patient to accept that there's an illness and look at the treatment options and be a participant in the care.
Do you see, when you hear these studies that the particularly antidepressants don't work that much better or even better at all than the placebo, from your experience and from what you have read, what is the effectiveness of Prozac, of Paxil and Zoloft in alleviating symptoms of depression and treating folks with depression?
Well, I see very good responses in a lot of my patients, but some of the patients do not have a good response to the medications. When they set up a research study, you have a placebo group and an active medication group. Now, there is response to a placebo because, you know, anytime you see a patient, it's providing some sort of a supportive therapy, and that has its benefits as well. The combination of treating somebody with depression with psychotherapy and medication tends to be more effective than either one alone.
Is it hard, looking at today's lifestyle and, you know, how busy folks are and just, you know, the increased acceptance of the drugs can help you, is it easier just to take the medicine and not go through with the weekly, biweekly counseling sessions and to do the other things, adjust your diet, exercise, that are also encouraged to try to help mental illness?
I think it is easier for some patients just to, you know, to take a medication and not always participate in some sort of a therapy. Now, I stress, you know, the need for therapy as far as at least some sort of supportive treatment. And the other things are important as well. You mentioned diet, exercise, and they've all shown to be helpful in somebody that has depression.
We're speaking with Dr. Kevin Ware. He is the chair of the Psychiatric Center at Mount Carmel Health Center here in Columbus. We're talking about the use of drugs and medication to treat mental illness and serious mental illness and what the long-term effects might be of those medications. Dr. Ware, have you seen any evidence of, or have you read of any problems with the long-term use of these antidepressants, that they lead to other psychiatric problems that actually could, if you use these medicines for too long a period of time, you can put yourself in a chronic situation of having chronic depression?
Well, with antidepressants, I haven't really seen any specific literature that indicated that there were long-term problems with the medications. You know, whether there's some you know, physiological effect or neurochemical changes, it's not completely clear. You know, some people have been treated for years with the medications and have done fine. Some people want to go off of the medication, and you know, I'm willing to work with them that, you know, here's some of the risks. Somebody that's had you know, one episode of a major depression, there's a 50% chance they're going to have a second. And after two, it's a 75% chance that they'll have more. After you've had three episodes of major depression, it gets to about a 90% risk that they're going to have another relapse recurrence. And so at that point, you're looking at chronic illness and need for ongoing treatment, or the significant likelihood of it returning. And it has a lot of difficulties with the impairments that it causes, and you know, the risks of ending one's life as a result of the major depression.
292-8513, if you'd like to join our guests here. We're talking about the use of medication to treat mental illness and the pros and cons of short-term and long-term use and what the effects might be. Let's go to the phones. And Alice from Columbus, you're on the air. Go ahead, Alice.
Yes, I would like to just mention that I have an adult mid-20s child that has schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia. And I do want to say that we went through all of the usual drugs, none of them which worked. And then we finally were very fortunate to have found Clozaril or clozapine, which has totally turned around bizarre behavior and total loss of personality, total loss of thinking, to absolute clear thinking, logic, reasoning, a return of personality, an extreme benefit, and a return to normalcy. We do find, or did find, that we had problems with the community mental health organization. The psychiatrist refused to put my daughter onto the Clozaril, and I believe that's due to the fact that it needs an extreme amount of monitoring. Mm. It's considered a black box drug, which means the pharmacy has to dispense it weekly. The blood has to be monitored weekly.
But so, Alice, basically your message is that your child has been helped by medication.
Absolutely. A life-changing turnaround. Another thing I do want to say is lithium is very beneficial when used in conjunction with Clozaril if there is a white blood cell drop to reverse that.
Okay.
Lithium.
Let's get our – I don't want to get too deep in the weeds of the medicine here, but thanks for the call, Alice. We appreciate it. We'll start with you, Dr. Ware. You're familiar with these medications? And
yes. Clozaril or clozapine, the generic, is a very effective antipsychotic medication. Works very well in the difficult-to-treat or refractory schizophrenia. And we've seen patients that haven't responded to most of the other medications in any appreciable fashion that have responded well to Clozaril. It's a different type of medication. It does require a lot of monitoring. They've changed the requirements. Initially, you do need weekly blood draws for the first 6 months, and then after that you can go to either 2 weeks or every 4 weeks for blood draws.
Mm-hmm. Robert Whitaker, the author, who's taken a critical look at the use of these drugs. Are you familiar with this drug and what the long-term effects might be? And do you have any, what has the research shown? What has your reporting shown on this drug?
Well, listen, there's clearly a group of people who can be good responders to clozapine. There's no question about that, that are treatment resistant to the other drugs. That's when it's used generally. And that's what I was saying when we try to figure out for whom and for how long. Mm-hmm. There's some people that clearly benefit from long-term use. What I'm trying to say, though, we need to bring into this story is the literature about the aggregate outcomes. And say, for example, this study by Martin Harrow. He found over a 20-year period, and this is the largest long-term study we have, that the recovery rate for those off medication, and this meant they were working more than half time, was 40%. It was 5% for those on medication. So that's an eightfold higher recovery rate. And what Martin Harrell concluded is there's a subset of patients, maybe a large subset of patients, that would do better off medication, but we don't have a paradigm of care that allows for this selective use and tries to figure out who needs it and who can do better off. That's the problem, mm-hmm. And the problem is that we don't know this other story.
Dr. Ware,
yes.
That question, for whom and for how long, how do you answer that question when you are treating a specific patient?
Well, with the example of schizophrenia, it is not felt to be a disease that can be cured necessarily, but improved, maintained, stabilized. and the treatment is felt to be long-term. Now, we do continue to assess the patients, see how they're responding, see if there's side effects or problems, make adjustments, sometimes trying to lower the dose. And often our patients do have problems with compliance with the antipsychotics. A majority of them do not think that they are ill, so they go off their medications. So we do see what happens when they are off the medications. Some people do well. They don't, they don't come back. They improve. Sometimes we look at the diagnosis, re-examine that. It, may have been transferred. A patient was started on meds, certain diagnosis, transferred to me, and I don't necessarily say, okay, I'll just, continue them on and do nothing. I reevaluate. I do a full interview and evaluation, examination, and see if I feel that they are on the right treatment and do we need to make any changes or consider that, maybe this wasn't schizophrenia. Maybe it was a brief psychosis. Maybe it was schizophreniform and never developed into full schizophrenia.
Does this get to the start, Robert Whitaker, does this start with the just the unique nature of a of an illness of the brain as opposed to an illness of the kidney or the heart or the lung, in that we still don't know a whole lot about what causes these things and what the symptoms are and if this is schizophrenia or something else?
Yeah, I think that's the key, the crux of this whole question, is that the brain is such an extraordinarily complex place. It's really a black box, in other words, trying to understand what's going on. And, we went down this path where we believed, or the society was believed, that the answers had been found. You know, there's this reductionist model. You just have this neurotransmitter that's out of balance. We can fix it. And that's just it's a reductionist metaphor that's not accurate. And really, there's no shame in this, but the brain is extraordinarily complex. Why we have certain symptoms is extraordinarily complex. When we speak about schizophrenia, no one really believes there's one schizophrenia. They'll talk about actually a group of schizophrenias. And if you talk about a group of schizophrenias, there may be a lot of many different types of things going on biologically, none of which we really know. And once you view schizophrenia or psychosis in that way, it's pretty easy to understand why some people might do well on the meds short term, some people might need them long term, but there may be other groups of people that in fact don't need long-term. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the problem is the brain's very complex. We really don't understand the pathology of mental disorders. And clearly there's an interaction with the environment as well. Mm-hmm. And so that's why this is so difficult and also why the medications may be problematic for some long-term.
Dr. Kevin Ware from Mount Carmel, assess your, you've studied this, you've practiced this for a number of years, you've done a lot of research and read a lot of research. How would you assess right now what we as a medical society, what is your level of understanding of how the brain works?
Well, it's ongoing. We're continuing to learn more and more. And, I would agree that we don't know enough. We're doing the best at this point in time, but there is more than just something within the brain. There's the stress diathesis model that looked at if you had the potential for schizophrenia, the genetics were there, it may or may not develop, but some stressful environment, etc., could trigger that. They looked at twins, and identical twins may only have a 50% concordance of having schizophrenia. If one has it, 50% chance that the other will. So there's clearly beyond biological, but it is a biopsychosocial type of model as well.
We're looking at the benefits, the drawbacks to using medication to treat mental illness. What are the long-term effects? What are the short-term benefits and effects? Let's go to the phones. Victor, you're on the air. Go ahead, Victor. You're on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
I just wanted to say that while, as a total layperson, while I completely believe that there are people who are genuinely mentally ill and need long-term help of some sort, a lot of people that I've interacted with who have been termed as depressive and have been given medication were people who dealt with difficult times in their lives. They faced what we could broadly call adversity. They had problems at work, they had problems in the family, they had deaths in the family. And they responded to it in a very natural way by not being happy. And a lot of times when they sought help for not being happy, they were diagnosed as being depressive and given medication. And to me, that is just philosophically kind of wrong. I don't think it genuinely addresses the issue. I think there is nothing wrong with being sad if there is something horrible that happened in your life. And I think we want, as a society, to give this medication out to these types of people, because broadly speaking, in America, it's not okay to be sad. It's not okay to be unhappy. So regardless of what the cause of your quote-unquote depression is, we want to treat it, end it, get it out of the way, because, my God, that's not you being normal.
Okay, let's get a response from Dr. Ware, the psychiatrist from Mount Carmel. Dr. Ware, how do you determine when a person is depressed and as opposed to just being down in the dumps because of a bad life situation, a death or a loss of a job or something like that?
Well, it starts with a thorough evaluation and examination of what's going on, what the symptoms are, precipitating events, or did it just come on irregardless of anything else? And then you have to look at what are the symptoms, the severity, and the impairment that they cause. Can the person function? Can they sleep? Can they concentrate? How's the energy or appetite? There's a lot of things that we look at before considering a medication. At least in my practice, that's how I do it. Some people, if you have the loss of a spouse, that's something that somebody's going to go through a grief period and hopefully a return in functioning, and you have to look at how severe it is. If there's hopelessness, suicidal thinking, things that are more requiring an urgent treatment. And so there's a lot of factors that go into considering medications.
Dr. Ware, you're a psychiatrist. Should family physicians be prescribing these medications, or should the person be treated by a psychiatrist?
Well, unfortunately, there's a shortage of physicians that are in psychiatry, and we can't see or treat everybody. And, it's a waiting list to get into my office, and I do both inpatient, outpatient work and consultations in hospitals. So we do rely on the family physicians who are required to take, psychiatric training within their residencies. Mm-hmm. And, we're always happy to consult with other physicians, and there's a lot of education that goes on. And so as a result, they've gotten much better at identifying depression and severity and knowing when to treat with medication. There are some rating scales that are useful that can be given in a primary care office. And that kind of helps to guide the knowledge when to treat with medication or without.
Robert Whitaker, science journalist, looked carefully at this. Is that a problem that too many family physicians, obviously intelligent people, know something about this, but aren't the specialists in this area? It's a practical situation, as Dr. Ware just said. There aren't that many. There aren't as many psychiatrists as there are family doctors.
Actually, I do think this is a big problem. I think it's a big problem because actually going on a medication is sort of a profound step. Your brain is modified. It's difficult to get off. It can be a long, you're starting off what often turns into a long-term journey. So I think it should be carefully considered when you start the medication. What your caller said, I think, is we are medicating unhappiness, difficulties in life. Probably not going to respond to drugs. You got to fix your life, that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think this is a big problem, is that the family care physician it might prescribe too readily. And you really need experts who are really can weigh the costs and benefits and really figure out when do you want to start this drug and be cautious about that. And I think actually psychiatrists, if they adopted that role, could really do us a great favor in society to be the cautious prescribers.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll speak with a man who has overcome his schizophrenia. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Economist Simon Johnson says bitter debates about the national debt date back to the earliest days of the Republic. On the next Fresh Air, Simon Johnson explores the meaning of the national debt and prospects for managing it. He's the co-author of the new book, White House Burning. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record, Friday night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss the general election, taking shape as a race between President Obama and Mitt Romney. What's next for Ohio's sex offender law? And the remaking of Columbus's rivers. Those topics and more on Columbus on the Record Friday night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Marburn Academy, a leader in ADHD and dyslexic education, inviting you to an evening open house, Monday, April 9th at 7 p.m. More at marburnacademy.org.
49 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly cloudy skies today with some sunshine and a high of 55. Clear skies tonight, a low of 35 degrees. Patchy frost for tomorrow morning, sunshine in the afternoon, a high near 60. And All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the use of medicine to treat mental illness. Do we prescribe it too much, or is it the best way to address and to help people cope with diseases like depression and schizophrenia and other serious mental illnesses and even chronic mental illnesses? Our guest right now is Mark Sullivan. As a young man, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Now he is the clinical director of counseling at Vineyard Columbus. Mark, welcome to All Sides.
Good to be here.
What's your story, Mark? When were you diagnosed and how were you treated at first?
Well, I was diagnosed in my senior year of high school. I was 17 years old. And that was preceded by probably at least a couple of years of pretty significant depression and some suicidal thinking. And at the point that I got diagnosed, I was actually actively delusional and had been hospitalized. Mm.
So what kind of symptoms were you having? You said you were depressed, obviously. And
well, I had delusions of, paranoid delusions. I also had delusions of grandiosity, where I thought that I was Saint Mark, I thought I was Jesus, I mm-hmm. thought that this young woman was the Virgin Mary that I was infatuated with. I had all kinds of crazy ideas, and initially, you know, I was so agitated and out of control. I was medicated and straitjacketed, and of course, this is back in the early 70s, and
So I was going to ask, how did your treatment begin? Was it your parents, your teachers that brought you to physicians, to doctors?
Yeah, my parents realized something was wrong. And then I was admitted to a hospital in my hometown. They were proposing doing electroshock therapy on me. One of my father's friends, whose son had been through that, said, don't let them do that to him. Transferred me down here to Columbus, to Riverside. I was in and out of Riverside several times. Eventually, in my senior year of high school, I was sent out to a psychiatric institution, Institute of the Living, out in Hartford, Connecticut, and I spent about 5 months there.
How long did your condition last?
Well, I think I had one more hospitalization after that. And I should also mention there was, you know, I was one of those teenagers who was involved in a lot of acting out and juvenile delinquency and drug abuse, too, before mm-hmm. all this started. So there certainly would be some influence there, the types of drugs that I was abusing. But I probably, within 2 or 3 years, I was completely off of all my medication. and haven't had so much as any kind of relapse or any kind of even depression or anything since then. Now that was over 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I like to tell people I'm a schizophrenic. I've just been in remission for 30 years.
So that was. Do you consider yourself cured?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think led to that cure? Was it the treatment you received then? I mean, the medication you received then? What do you think has helped you succeed and overcome this?
Well, you know, one psychiatrist described schizophrenia as, you know, a reaction to extreme stress. I had a lot of stress from things that I was involved in and a lot of emotional stress and guilt for violating values that I'd been taught in my devout Roman Catholic family and the stress of worrying about transitioning into adulthood. I mean, we see a lot of kids between, you know, the ages of 15 and 25 who have these experiences. It's a very stressful time of life. And so partly with support of my family and support of a church that I got involved in, and there was a psychiatrist in the church who was willing to help me wean off the medication. And so I think it was basically being in an environment, a supportive environment, where people basically treated me like, yeah, you're young, immature, you're stressed out, we'll help you, we'll support you. And they weren't pressing this issue of schizophrenia. And because I believe that in many cases it tends to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, do you believe you had schizophrenia or you were misdiagnosed?
I don't think it's either or. It's either one of those. I think that I had these symptoms that we call schizophrenia. They're symptoms, extreme reactions to the stress that I was under. Just as some people get stressed, they get backaches, they get headaches, they get stomach aches. I mean, we have physiological reactions. This happened to be mine. Mm-hmm. And so I believe in many cases it's treated in a calm, reassuring way, and we don't indoctrinate people into the idea that this is a lifelong disease that you can never recover from, then they have a better shot at coming out of it.
How much credit do you give, if any, to the medications that you took during the height of your condition, during the worst times?
I'm sure that when I was in my most psychotic states, it calmed me down. I mean, it numbed my brain, you know. And I'm not going to denigrate that. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, in the long run, I think it was far better for me to get off of the medication and be told, encouraged, that I could recover and I could get better. Now, fortunately, there was a psychiatrist who was able to give me those messages. Mm-hmm. But, you know, unfortunately, most people who've experienced the symptoms that I experienced don't get those messages.
Dr. Ware from Mount Carmel, you haven't treated Mark here, obviously, but from what you've heard, what do you make of his case?
Well, what he's describing, those symptoms did sound like a schizophrenic break and ongoing symptoms of delusions and behavior changes, depression. But there may have been other factors. Stress can certainly bring on things like that, and so can drug use. Within the schizophrenic population, there is a 50% comorbidity with drug use. Sometimes we do see people that's what brought on the symptoms, and you get them sober in treatment and free of substances, and the symptoms do improve. The onset of schizophrenia in a male typically is between 15 and 25. So, you know, a lot of the things did fit, but, you know, got treated and sounds like has been successfully maintained off medication, and I think that's great.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned earlier that there is no cure for schizophrenia. Does Mark's case contradict that? Do you perhaps think that it wasn't a classic case of schizophrenia, or at least a serious case of schizophrenia?
Well, not knowing all the facts or having met or treated him, it's hard to speculate. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the diagnosis at the time fit. That I don't know exactly what treatment was given, but we do see recovery. We do see improvement. It's not, but it's not always, the diagnosis being accurate, schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. There are other forms of psychosis that can appear the same, have similar symptoms, respond to the treatment. You know, there's something brief psychotic episode or brief psychotic reaction.
Mm-hmm. Robert Whitaker, science journalist, has written a book, Critical Look at the Use of Medicines. In Mark's case, in the case of many people who are put on these medications, it's almost an emergency situation where they could harm themselves, first and foremost, or harm others. That is a proper role. I would argue that it is a proper role for medication in treating these most serious cases.
Well, sure. Society has to have a response mm-hmm. that contains that possibility of violence or whatever you want to call it, aggressiveness. And medications can, as Mark said, they can numb the brain and sort of quiet people, and so that can be a good use. I will tell you the society in the Western world that has the best long-term outcomes for first episode schizophrenia, first episode psychosis is in northern Finland, and they try to avoid use of antipsychotics. They'll use benzodiazepines to quiet people. But beginning in 1992, they decided that the long-term course with antipsychotics was too problematic and that getting people on the antipsychotics too often led to a long-term course. So they actually avoid initial use of the antipsychotics. And now they have changed the long-term course of schizophrenia in their society. And only about one-third of their patients are ever exposed to antipsychotics. It's not placebo, though. They throw a lot of psychosocial care at the person right from the first episode. So, and they do use benzodiazepines to do some of this quiet thing. But 5 years later, they have 80% of their patients off medication and working or back in school.
But they supplement it with a lot of other things.
Intensive psychosocial care, okay? So it's not placebo. They're throwing a lot of social resources to help people get through that crisis and then build bridges back to society.
Okay, let's go back to the... Oh, go ahead, Dr. Ware.
I just want to make a quick comment. With the first episode of psychosis, schizophrenia, the majority are responsive to treatment. They have very good responses. It's a long-term continued relapse that does have a downward course and does have impact on the brain as well.
All right, let's go to the phones. Go ahead, Jane, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to say I have a daughter in her 50s that has schizophrenia. She works very closely with her psychiatrist and has responded the best recently on Zoloft and Haldol and is doing very well. But I am concerned that your guest, Mr. Whitaker, is bringing a new light on some of this, and somebody that has a severe mental illness is going to listen to this and may stop their medications. That's my comment. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it, Jane. Bob Whitaker, that's a complaint. That's a fear that a lot of psychiatrists have, and folks who need these medications will stop taking them.
Right. And going off your medications when you've been on them for a long term, especially antipsychotics, can be really risky, okay? And there's reasons why that is so. And I certainly did not write this book with any intention of giving medical advice. It's not a medical advice book. It's just looking at what science is telling us in the aggregate about how societies treat different disorders and whether we're doing well or whether we might want to adjust this paradigm to try to get much better at it. But nobody should listen to this interview and make any medical decision. And going off your medications can be very risky, especially antipsychotics.
Dr. Kevin Ware, I assume you would agree with that.
Oh, yes. If you're... It's hard to, for patients to stay on their medications in a lot of cases, but if they're planning to go off, it's best to discuss it with your doctor and, start there. It's just like with, we always try to relate it to other medical conditions, with diabetes, with hypertension. It's not recommended to just go off your medication, but to stay on it, work with your doctor, and try to get the best effectiveness, and if you can reduce meds, that's great.
Mark Sullivan, having overcome your schizophrenia, you now counsel folks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is there ever a time where you say this person needs medication? That you've talked to one of your folks that you've seen, you refer them to a physician?
I discuss it with the client. I mean, there are clients that I thought didn't necessarily need medication that wanted to be on medication, and part of psychotherapy is you've got to go where the client is, wants to go. You have to But you know, coming off of medications, I mean, on a psychological level is a scary thing to do too. And I remember being very anxious about it. So there's a psychological piece where the person also needs lots of support. But, you know, if the client wants medication and believes that that's going to be helpful, whether it's placebo effect or chemical effect or whatever, that's very important, you know, that that we this is a client-centered type of therapy that we've all been trained to do, and I think wisely so.
Dr. Ware, say you have a patient who has lost a spouse and goes through a severe time, a very sad, depressed bout of depression. But time passes, the sadness alleviates and goes away. What's the role of the physician, a psychiatrist, to wean his or her patient off of the drugs? How active a role can you take as a physician to get someone to stop taking drugs if you feel that's the best course of action?
Very active. We, you know, would try to take it slowly, reduction, tapering, to try to minimize any problems related to coming off of it, and also to support them and discuss, you know, you're doing better. I feel like this is the right approach. Or, you know, excuse me, if that's what they want to do, then we just go ahead and work with them in the best way possible to minimize any ill effects.
What if you think they could be better served off the medication, but they don't want to get off the medication? What's that conversation like?
Well, I would listen to them and find out the reasons why and you know, try to discuss, you know, my thoughts on it and, you know, continue to address it. I might say, well, you know, let's discuss it next time. I'll give you some things to think about. And, you know, I'm not going to force it on them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, you know, if I feel strongly that it should be stopped or at least decreased, I'm going to continue to discuss that with the patient and take an active, you know, role that way.
Robert Whitaker, is it the patients are partly to blame in this, and that, you know, this worked for me during that period where I lost my spouse and I was really down and not feeling well at all, and it helped me through that period, and I don't want to take the risk that I go back there?
Well, sure. I mean, that's you can understand that patients don't want to go back there. It can be really difficult. I think this all occurs within a larger societal discussion about what it means to be alive and what it means to be normal and what sort of responses we have to things. And we have created a society where we think you can take a pill, you feel better, you don't have to work on your life. And that's a bit of a problem, I think, long term. But patients have been, or people have been, considered to take your pill and everything will be all right. And unfortunately, I don't think that's quite the answer.
Sure. Thanks, Robert Whitaker, author of Anatomy of an Epidemic, a critical look at how we are using medication to treat mental illness here in the United States. Thanks, Robert Whitaker. Dr. Kevin Ware, he is the chairman and medical director of the Department of Psychiatry at the Mount Carmel Medical Center here in Columbus. Thank you, Dr. Ware.
Thank you.
And Mark Sullivan, thank you for joining us and sharing your story. And I wish you all the best, and as you can continue to work with others and help them through their mental illness.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Mike Thompson. I've been sitting in for Ann Fisher today. She returns tomorrow here on 89.7 NPR News, WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. And, of course, we're streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News is a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to support WOSU. More on leaving a legacy at 292-9678.